Welcome to Campfire. Campfire provides solution-focused conversations to influence positive change for health, well-being and safety in agriculture. This podcast has been developed as part of Building Farm Spirit by the National Centre for Farmer Health.
How do you help a child who's been through a traumatic event like a fire or a flood? And even if they do seem okay, what behaviours should you keep an eye out for that actually signal they do need a hand? G'day, I'm Drew Radford, and these are important questions, but they're not always easy to answer. So we've invited into the Campfire studio someone who can help. Clinical neuropsychologist Jane Nursey, who is Head of Clinical Services for Phoenix Australia. Jane, thanks for your time.
Pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Jane, Phoenix is there to help all Australians, and your role there now is Head of Clinical Services. However, throughout your career, I imagine you've been on the ground helping in times of crises and disasters.
Yeah, so in different positions that I've held in different organisations. So during the 2009 Victorian Black Saturday bushfires, I was managing an outpatient trauma recovery service at the Austin Hospital at that point, and we played a major role funded by government to go out into all of the local communities that had been impacted by those Black Saturday bushfires and help the communities by supporting the local recovery services, building some capacity for them. So we would provide advice and support. We might do some training and education around trauma and impacts of trauma and recovery and how to recover. We worked with the local mental health service to support them as they supported their clients. We also set up a clinical service for members of the community to be able to use. And we sat and worked with the local recovery committee. So I would sit on a number of advisory committees in different regions. I also did a lot of work in schools at that time, so supporting teachers in terms of their own recovery, but also in terms of how they can support children in classrooms.
Jane, can you paint me some broad brushstrokes of how something like the 2022 floods and also stressful farming seasons can affect a farming family?
Yes, look, I guess there can be many, many different ways it can impact on families. But I think one of the most pernicious ones really is just the constant high level of stress and distress that it can cause within families. So, you know, the parents being under a huge amount of pressure financially, professionally, constantly worrying about survival really of stock, survival of their farms, those sorts of things. But also I think, you know, more broadly, you can have impacts on social isolation. So often, particularly floods, lead to families being stranded or isolated from communities. People who are traumatized and stressed often disconnect from their communities, and often the stress anyway means that they're working extra long hours and to get involved in more social activities. So that can be another major stressor. I think the other thing is loss, dealing with loss and dealing with grief. You know, floods, but also hard farming years involve a lot of loss and a lot of insecurity in terms of what the future might hold and what it might look like and how they're going to get through this period. So it just puts a huge amount of stress, not only on the parents, but then on the children as well, who might have experienced directly a disaster like the flood, but also experience indirectly the trauma of the farm. Just, you know, issues. And in fact, they're usually involved in farming anyway. So, you know, they experience those same sorts of stresses, not just vicariously, but directly.
Well, Jane, following on from that, in terms of those stresses impacting upon children, what sort of behaviours might be observed in farm kids that have been through an event like a flood or a protracted thing like a drought?
Well, it can really vary quite a bit depending on the age of the child, depending on the level of support they have, both within the family, but also at a more community level and social level. But often, particularly if we take the flood situation, a disaster situation, what you will find is that even very young children, infants, just like adults, will have a reaction to that. And that will express itself in a number of different ways. So for infants, it's likely that they'll be more irritable than they normally are. They might not sleep as well. They might not feed easily. They might be very clingy, cry a lot, and be harder to settle down. For preschool children, you can get things similar to that. So they might experience all of those sorts of issues, but also might develop some new fears and phobias. And so suddenly become quite fearful about new situations or even old situations. You know, it might be going away from the farm becomes quite frightening for them, or having the parents go off to work or leave for the day to do what they have to do becomes a significant problem. School refusal can sometimes become a bit of an issue too. The other thing that you can see in young children, preschoolers and that age group, is a regression in learned skills. So things like toileting and language development and motor skills can all take a bit of a backward step. For school-age children and adolescents, again, you can see disruptions in sleep, you can see disruptions in eating behaviour, you can see new anxieties and fears coming up. You might find that, particularly from a flood experience, suddenly aware of limitations of life and become more aware of death, really, and how that might happen. And so develop new fears around that. Some kids withdraw into themselves, become very quiet, don't want to engage with their siblings, don't want to engage with their peers. Many will struggle at school for a period of time, have concentration problems. Anger can be a problem for a while as well. So yeah, there's just a whole range of different responses that you can see depending on the age of the child.
Jane, it's a lot to consider and keep an eye out, for want of a better description. And then on top of it, as a parent, you're dealing with trying to get the property back up and going, or financial stresses or whatever. So I'm guessing the parent's own coping style and mental health and well-being is going to influence the child's recovery as well. It's a complex web.
Absolutely. And it's a double whammy for families, really, because for the children, they're very dependent upon the parent, really. They look to the parent for how they're coping, for what they should be doing, for whether or not they should be worried. And for parents, if it's an overwhelming experience, they're going to have to show distress. They're going to be distressed, even if they try to cover that up. The children are going to pick up on that. And so the more they'll get then frightened by that as well. So it can become really difficult for parents who feel like they've got to be brave and strong for the kids in order to sort of get the family through it, to then actually feel guilt if they're not able to do that in a satisfactory way or to their own standards. And we do know that disasters and high-level trauma and stress impact on parenting skills. You know, you can't be as devoted to and as closely involved with your kids when you're trying to survive and trying to sort of recover from a major event like a disaster. So there's a bit of give and take that has to happen with the parents. They have to be able to take a step back, but they also have to prioritise looking after themselves, because the children are really dependent upon the parents looking after their own mental health and modelling what that looks like and helping the children to manage their own emotional reactions as well.
What should parents and guardians be looking out for after an event that may be signs that you can't manage this yourself, you might need to seek help? What sort of things should they be looking for?
Well, I think the first thing to be mindful is that It's very common for everyone, from infants to older people, to demonstrate initial emotional difficulties and behavioural changes after something as traumatic as that. And we expect to see problems like the types that I've described, and for them to hang around for a number of weeks, if not a few months. But by far, what we expect to see is the majority of people will slowly recover from that and get back to their pre-trauma level of functioning, if you like. But there's still going to be a percentage, I guess, about 10%, maybe up to 20%, maybe higher in some situations where there might be a lot of domestic violence and those sorts of things going on in families as well, where both the children and the adults are vulnerable to experiencing more problematic mental health disorders like post-traumatic stress disorder or depression or anxiety. Some of the behaviours we see in children and that are really important to look out for are just shifts in their behaviour. Are they acting in a way that's different? Are they continuing to be irritable and angry and oppositional, to have difficulty sleeping? You know, if any of those sorts of issues are continuing on beyond a few weeks, then they're signs that you really need to be reaching out for help sooner rather than later. For very young children, you'll often see very repetitive play in them. You know, the play is the way they process all of the information and the events that have gone on for them. And if there's a lot of repetitive play in reenacting a trauma such as a flood or a loss of home or materials because of a hard farming year, then that will be a sign also that they're struggling. So I think those behavioural signs are really important to keep an eye on. And it might be that they're sometimes and not others, but if they're continuing to sort of be there, at least even some of the time after a few months, then it's good to seek help. Sleep absolutely is a vital sign. If they're unable to sleep, if they're waking frequently, if they're crying and unable to be settled, or it's taking a long time to settle them, then those sorts of signs are again a bit of an issue. And for older kids, adolescents, if they're either completely withdrawn and not willing to engage, very clingy with parents, not wanting to let parents out of their sight, or if in adolescence they're beginning to take really unreasonable risks, you know, more than we expect in a normal adolescent, not wanting to engage with parents, not wanting parents to know, what they're doing more than might normally have been the case, then those sorts of changes are flags that need to be taken seriously and go and pursue some assistance.
What do you think can help kids get through some of these tough times? What are some of your top tips?
One of the most important thing is connectedness to others. So we know that social connections with other people, whether it be within family or outside of family, is one of the best predictors of recovery following a disaster. So keeping yourselves connected as a family is really important, and sometimes that's going to be really hard, particularly in flood situations. The family might get separated and the kids have to go and off live with a relative while the parents stay and try and move through the recovery process. So if that happens, you know, it's really important to find ways of remaining connected, and whether that be through Zoom, whether it be through weekly visits, whether it be whatever. But that connectedness is paramount. And for kids, it's also connectedness through schools and peer groups. So ensuring that you can schedule activities together as a family where A, you're connecting together, but B, you're connecting with other people and having fun is really, really important. Another really important thing is just being really honest and open with your kids. Kids know when we're not telling the full truth, and they also have very vivid imaginations, and they will imagine the worst is going to happen again if it's not spoken about and they're not reassured. So it is really important to allow kids to have a space to talk about how they're feeling, to ask questions about what happened and what's going to happen in the future, and for parents to be really honest in their responses about that. talk in the language that's suitable for the age group and that makes sense to the child. But don't try to hide things away because they will pick up on that and that's going to increase their anxiety. Giving them lots of cuddles or lots of love, you know, they are going to be feeling distressed and they need lots of reassurance that things are okay, that everything will be okay. And even if it's not going to be okay, that you're there together as a family, working together and with the community as well to make things better so that they're not alone in this. The other thing is that for some kids, they might see it as their responsibility and their fault, particularly if they've been through a flood and have had to play a role in getting themselves to safety or helping the family get to safety. They might often see that they did something wrong, or even young kids can just imagine that it's happened because they've been naughty or done something. So just reassurance that that's not the case and that things will improve. Model good coping skills is really important for parents. Unfortunately, one of the things that happens following a disaster and in high stress times is that our tempers are shortened and we often will become much more irritable ourselves. We'll lash out. It'll be hard to contain our anger because anger is often the best way of releasing that stress. So really important that you're monitoring your own behavioural responses and you're practicing good self-care skills and good emotional coping skills. You know, do some relaxation, some deep breathing. Make sure you're putting in the day some sort of activity that's going to allow you to relax and take a bit of a backward step. Also, understanding that every member of the family will react differently. You won't all have the same response. And some family members might not understand the response in another family member, and that can cause conflict as well. So I think it's really important to recognise and be appreciative of the fact that everyone's going to have an individual reaction and for parents to be tuning into their kids and understanding their own unique reactions and their own unique needs in that. So those discussions with kids about what they want, what they need and providing the support that they're saying they're needing is really important.
Jane, we're talking a lot about how we can help children, but I imagine they also want to be part of the solution, i.e. that they're helping themselves, they're contributing. So I'm also wondering then if that actually adds to their own personal recovery.
Absolutely. I would see it as an essential part of their recovery, really, for any age group, in fact. Even young toddlers at some level like to feel like they're doing something to help. And one of the flood situations I'd worked in, there was a family with four or five children of different ages, and the youngest one was a number of years younger than the other children, and they were all helping mum and dad in terms of the cleanup and the recovery, and this child felt a bit left out of that process. So they were given the task of looking after the family pets. So they really took it quite seriously of setting up a special place in the home for the pets, providing and making a special sort of space for the dog and the cat that was their own, and bought their toys and made sure that they had water and fed them and looked after them and took them for walks and those sorts of things. And that became a really powerful part of that child's recovery, and they felt that they were contributing in the same way that their older siblings had contributed as well.
Jane, dealing with the event, I'm wondering if getting farm kids to make a photo journal of the flood and recovery on their farm, or documenting it or writing about it after the event, helps in any way.
I think that storytelling is another really important part of the recovery process. And, you know, for kids doing that either through a video storyline, so there's certainly, I've been aware of kids in one disaster area who did take it upon themselves to actually almost do YouTube series. I don't know if it was on YouTube, I can't remember now, but they were documenting the recovery, not only of their own farm and property, but also of the local community, and going and interviewing people and asking them how they felt and what they were doing and those sorts of things. And from that point of view, it was just a very clever way of piecing together a narrative or a story that helped not only them make sense of what had happened and what was happening and what the recovery process was doing, but also the people who they showed that to, members of their family, members of their community.
That storytelling, extrapolating that a little bit further, what about involving them in terms of preparation for potentially the next time, preparing disaster plans, or even getting to the point of where it's safe, doing things like filling sandbags or whatever the case may be?
Absolutely. I would say that that's not only a good idea, but probably an essential one. I think particularly for rural families and people living in regional and or remote regions, it is absolutely essential that the children are involved in that emergency planning, not only so that they're fully aware of what they might need to do the next time an emergency hits, but also because they've got some really good ideas that they can contribute to that and to help prepare it and put it into place. So there's lots of resources out there for, you know, Red Cross in particular has lots of resources for helping families make emergency plans, but also for children to be involved in that. So I think that even at a family level, it's really important to involve children in your own emergency plans, for children to have their own roles in terms of enacting those emergency plans, but also that at a community level that they're also involved.
Jane, you've talked about how young people can help and contribute, but have you seen examples or opportunities where they can take even another step in terms of advocating for their community?
Absolutely. You know, there's been a number of examples of, you know, young people really taking on initiatives, getting themselves out there, connecting themselves to people in the know, connecting themselves to government, connecting themselves to key community leaders, to researchers, to local support agencies, and being out there and advocating for the role that young people can play in community recovery and response, and engaging with media to talk about that, engaging with research groups that might be able to help them develop a broader approach to advocating for that. So there's many examples of young people being empowered to do those sorts of things and getting a huge rewards from it in terms of managing and contributing to their own recovery, really.
Jane, it's a really interesting change in perspective in some regards, because I imagine many parents want to shield their children from any further ongoing trauma or the trauma being dragged out, but there's actually an opportunity in all this to empower them.
I think that's right. Often parents do feel like, well, you know, they've been through enough. We don't want them to be exposed to anything else that might be stressful or traumatic. But I think the flip side of it is, you know, if you can find something that they're passionate about and that they're obviously showing a skill for and a desire to again engage with, then there's plenty of opportunities to find ways of them being able to do something that doesn't re-traumatize them. It actually helps their recovery. And we need to remember that, you know, avoidance of thinking about, of talking about what's happened is actually not going to aid recovery. That's going to actually make recovery perhaps more difficult. So the more that we can encourage and engage children in actively doing something around recovery, including talking about it with others, including bringing people together, including setting up activities that brings people together, all of that sort of stuff is going to be incredibly empowering for them as individuals and help not only their own recovery, but the people that they're engaging with them.
Parents want the best for their kids. You've listed some great examples of how to look out and help and provide those good environments. Sometimes we can't fix it all ourselves, though, can we? So what happens when you can't? I mean, how do you go about getting some help for a child if you're concerned about them?
Yeah, so I think the first thing is to not be hard on yourself for not being able to fix it. You know, this reality is that it's not possible sometimes for a parent to fix it or for a single person to fix it. So I think don't expect perfection in yourself and be kind to yourself. Recognise that maybe getting some help is really important. So I think the best option and the most important option is to have a GP and a relationship with the GP that you can go to and talk about what's happened and seek some referrals to a mental health professional or a counsellor who might be able to provide some support to you and your child. Schools also become a really important resource in disasters. Schools are second homes for kids, and the relationships they build at school with their peers and with their teachers are vitally important to their well-being. Yet sometimes the schools might no longer be there following a flood or disaster. So really important that if they're moving off into new schools, that you're engaging with the teaching staff at that new school, you're meeting some of the new parents, and you're helping the child to re-establish some of those connections. But also leaning on, you know, if you are still engaged in the same school, really talking with teachers, finding out how the child is at school and whether or not there are any issues, and asking for their advice and support also. You know, one of the responses in the recent review of mental health, at least in Victoria, was recognise the importance of having more psychological wellbeing staff in schools because of the increased number of disasters that are happening and impacting on schools. So making use of those resources. I think also often, you know, it's hard, particularly in rural communities, farming families, to actually reach out and ask for help. There is this sort of stoical view that you keep it in the family, we deal with it, we're responsible for our own recovery. And I would just urge parents to recognise that that's not actually being helpful. You have to rely on others to help you through these really traumatic times. Everybody does. And so it's really in your children's best interests and in your own best interests to take advantage of the support that is available in the community for you. The other thing is keeping a routine. Routines get disrupted in emergencies, in floods, in bushfires, even when things aren't going well in families. And children rely on routine to feel safe. So whatever you can do to re-establish a routine, both within what goes on in the family, meal times, sleep times, those sorts of things, but also in terms of social activities and in terms of schooling, is really important. And the school can be quite helpful in providing that. So again, talking to the teachers. But GPs are a really important resource for finding the right help. There's a lot of resources online as well, and our own Phoenix Australia website has a lot of information on recovering after disasters and seeking help. There's places like Emerging Minds that also has a lot of resources there. The Red Cross is another really important one.
Lastly, Jane, on a positive side, do families grow closer because they've faced, you know, a difficult season or an adversity like a flood?
They can do, and that's something that we might fall into the category of what's known as post-traumatic growth. So the idea that a really terrible event, such as a flood, actually creates a new way of seeing the world and gives new insights to people and helps them make decisions about what they really value in life and what's important to them, and a determination, I guess, to really engage in a different way with people around them. And from that point of view, it can lead to really positive benefits to the family. I think the other thing is, if you as a family have been reliant on each other to survive during a flood, then that's going to bring you closer together. It might also cause some arguments, but it's ultimately in the end going to bring you closer together. You've got that extra level of bond there that you might not have had before, and a recognition of the importance of these family members to you. I would just put in a proviso there that there can also be, for some families though, it might not end in that way, and particularly where violence and anger becomes a predominant way of coping, that can be really destructive for families. So it's again an important warning about if that sort of thing is happening, if there's more aggression within the family, not just between parents, but between siblings, between parents and children, then it is absolutely vital that help gets sought early to manage that, because that can be really destructive on family bonds, obviously.
Jane, you've given some great insights and also really valuable tips, especially as, unfortunately, Australian farming families do often face adversity like floods, fires and drought. Jane Nursey, Head of Clinical Services for Phoenix Australia, thanks for joining us for this Campfire podcast.
Pleasure. Thank you, Drew.
Thank you for listening to the Campfire podcast. For more information about Campfire, please visit the National Centre for Farmer Health website. All information is accurate at the time of release. Series 2 of Campfire was developed by the National Centre for Farmer Health and is funded by the Victorian State Government's Flood Recovery Funding through Agriculture Victoria. For more resources to support your flood recovery journey, please access the hashtag Building Farm Spirit page on the NCFH website.